Welcome to Power Play. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program today, the provincial vaccine rollouts, confusion, delays, inequities, and some systems overwhelmed, and lots of the blame game.
We're limited by one thing, and I keep saying it. We need vaccines. It's a game changer.
But while the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, points fingers at the federal government's procurement, why is his own vaccine booking portal not ready for another 3 weeks? Why the slow start in that province compared to provinces like Alberta, which kicked off theirs today? And why is there still so much confusion as to who will deliver the vaccine and when? We'll talk to the retired General Rick Hillier, who oversees the Ontario vaccine rollout, and we'll dig into the other provinces as well. And then the next wave of vaccines?
On the week of March 8th, we are expecting over 460,000 doses of Moderna. The week of March 22nd, we're expecting over 840,000 doses of Moderna.
With new vaccine supplies coming, will Canada be able to hit its promised vaccine targets? The press gallery will dig into that with CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdu Sharkawi and CTV News political analyst will also join us. Plus, opening up medical assistance in dying. The government is under the gun of a court order to open up medically assisted deaths. Just how far, though, will the new access go? The Justice Minister, David Lametti, will join us on that and lots more. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. So as the Prime Minister announced new supplies of the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, as you just saw, they're coming late March and early April, he's still promising to hit or even exceed the 6 million doses by the end of March. But as he's doing that, provinces are rolling out their vaccine plans. Quebec says that people over 85 years and older will be able to get vaccinated starting next week. So they've got their mass vaccination plan, and they got sites like the Olympic Stadium in Montreal to roll those out. Alberta opened up a vaccine portal today to book a shot for people 75 years and over. That was so popular, the site crashed within minutes. Frustrating, but a clear indication that the demand to book an appointment is clearly intense. Today, Ontario rolled out its plan, and for many, it was a disappointment. Their vaccine portal for booking isn't going to be ready until March 15th, almost 3 weeks away. And the rollout is even slower. The Ontarians aged 80 and older can only start booking their vaccinations as of March 22nd. People 75 and up can start booking in April. People 70 and over will get access to the system in May. Those 65 and over can start booking their appointments by June. In other words, for most people in the province of Ontario under the age of 65, it'll be 6 months before they get a Pfizer or a Moderna shot. Apparently, essential workers will likely get their turn in the first week of May. Now, look, Canada is still aiming to get everyone who wants a vaccine inoculated by the end of September, but with a large portion of a province like Ontario still having to get vaccinated in a few months, is that possible? So there's lots of questions. Why don't people know when they're going to be able to get the shot or where they're going to get the shot? So we begin our program to try to get some answers for you with the man in charge of the Ontario Vaccine Distribution Task Force, the retired General Rick Hillier. Always good to have you on the show, sir. I always thank you for your service to our country. Let's start with the online booking system. You know, Alberta's up and running. The demand's heavy there. It even crashed. Why, after your province was asking, you know, we're waiting for the vaccines, why is the portal not up and running? Why is it not up and running till the middle of March?
Well, Evan, first of all, you know, looking at what Ontario or Alberta did today, we want to make sure we're absolutely ready. So we're glad to learn some lessons from them. And I know they'll work it out very quickly and have that part done. But here's the simple thing, Evan. We actually did not need the portal to do the 625,000 vaccinations that we have done to date. We are very focused in the first two priorities of those most vulnerable circumstances, our healthcare professionals, particularly those patient-facing, and we don't need them booking online because we are either taking the vaccine to them in their long-term care home or we are doing them in the mass vaccination clinics at the hospitals where most of them work. So we've done 625,000 vaccinations so far in Ontario, 250,000 people who've had both needles, 250,000 and a bit more, and we have not needed the portal for any of that. We knew that. We knew that we only needed the portal when we had sufficient vaccines to do the age bracket starting with age 80 and up.
But the Alberta example to me seems instructive. The vaccines are finally here in big numbers, 640,000 this week, as the Prime Minister said, more are coming. If you have the system up now, you can avoid the big rush to get it. It can be done in an orderly fashion, and it won't crash. And so give people some certainty, some understanding when they can book it, and they don't have to wait till the middle of March in the midst of all these vaccines arriving. So again, I'm just going to ask you, why was it not up and running on a week when the vaccines are arriving in big numbers, to give people a long runway to get set up?
Well, the vaccines are arriving in bigger numbers now, this week and next week, obviously, and they're all going into the populations that I talked about, into the second needles, for example, into those long-term care residents and essential caregivers, and into the healthcare professionals, patient-facing and sometimes second needles for them, and into our Indigenous people and First Nations populations, particularly along the north. So again, we have not needed the portals for that. Secondly, when the portal is operating, we will not be booking weeks and weeks out for reservations and appointments, because as we saw in February, after we got told, you know, on Friday that nothing is going to arrive on Monday, we would have end up canceling literally tens of thousands of appointments. So we will want to book closer to when we see the vaccines arriving, so that we can be certain that if you haven't are 80 years old and have booked an appointment for next Tuesday, you would be able to get the vaccine because it would be there for you. And so that's part of it. I would have loved to have seen the portals up running when I arrived here in late November. They weren't. We had to build them. And so we'll be ready for it. We'll do a soft launch over this next days here to make sure it is stress test, to make sure it is as ready as possible. When we go flat out on the 15th of March, it will be ready to go. And we'll have much more probability of it being successful.
Okay, there's a couple other issues. I'm just trying to figure out the timeline that I've outlined for your province. How is this going to work? So 80 and up starting the third week of March, and the timeline eventually moves to vaccinations for people 65 starting, and plus starting in June. That still leaves, by my count, the vast majority of the population of your province of Ontario, about 11 million people, to be vaccinated between July, August, and September to hit the... Is that possible to inoculate 11 million people in that time with Pfizer and Moderna?
I think by that stage in the game, if that indeed is a number, Evan, by that stage in the game, I think it would be very possible. But it all depends on what we're doing here and the way we're flowing it out. You make, you know, 80 starts the third week of March and flows all the way out. It's because of the availability of vaccines. And if we get more vaccines, we'll be able to pull that forward. If we got a lot more vaccines, we'll be able to pull it forward quite a ways. But those allocations of when you in this age bracket can get an appointment to get your vaccine, they're based on the availability of vaccines as we've been has been forecast to us, and the allocations that we know we're getting in the shorter term.
Wow, it's going to be, everybody under 65 in the province of Ontario. The other thing is people are confused, sir, about where they're going to get it, you know, where the mass vaccine centers are going to be. And again, I've spoken to family doctors, Dr. Marla Shapiro, our CTV News medical professional, Dr. Michelle Cohen, who's also a professional. They say they've had mixed messages, that they're getting patients calling them. Oh, I've heard family doctors are going to give this to, I'm over 80. They haven't been part of the plan. There's no clarity on that. When will there be a clear message as to where people can go to get their shot, when they're going to use their family doctor, when they're going to be able to go to a pharmacy? When's the clear, concise message on that going to be rolled out?
When our portal goes live on 15 March and our customer service desk, Evan, but there has been clarity on it. And so I would simply say to you, anybody that's 80 years old, you're going to get your vaccine close to where you live. Wherever your postal code shows up, close to where you are, there will be either a mass vaccination center or a pharmacy with the vaccine that you can go on and make an appointment with and get your vaccine there. There may be a mini mass vaccination center where family doctors have come together, and your doctor may be in one of those and will reach out to you to say, hey, come to this smaller mass vaccination clinic, and I will be there and I'll administer the vaccine to you. So you're going to get the vaccine really close to home in either a mass vaccination center, a pharmacy, or a smaller vaccination
center. But the doctors don't know this.
Yes, they do know this. And I talked to the
OMA. Okay, so because the doctors, go ahead.
So I've talked to the OMA. I've talked to a variety of other organizations representing the doctors and the professional, the primary care professionals in Ontario, and they are wonderful. They want to be part of the program, and here's what they can do and be part of. They want to be able to vaccinate not only their patients, but others also. We are not going to have vaccines in doctor's office in the foreseeable future. The Pfizer and Moderna characteristics just do not lend itself to that. So what we have said to the doctors and what the doctors are preparing for and actually already doing is working with the public health units either to become part of a mass vaccination clinic and have their patients come there. In Ottawa, for example, in September and October and November for the flu vaccine, that worked wonderfully. In other cases, doctors are forming SWAT teams, is what they call them, to go into, for example, long-term care homes and administer vaccines and then go back and administer the second. I've talked to some of the doctors at the OMA who have done that as part of it. So they're already part of that program. If they're in doubt, reach out to the medical officer of health in the public health unit where they reside. And if you're in Kingston as a doctor, right, you talk to Dr. Karen Moore.
Okay. Well, by the way, Dr. Michelle Cohen is in Kingston. She doesn't know. But that's interesting. You're saying doctors' offices won't be able to use them because a lot of doctors are saying, hey, you don't need the cold chain storage anymore for Pfizer. That had been a change of protocol. They say they have freezers for Moderna. But that's interesting. So it won't be happening in doctors' offices in the 34 different public health issues. Will the approval, a potential approval of AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson accelerate this whole timeline, General?
Oh, my, yes. AstraZeneca offers an incredible level of protection. It really, really does. And its handling characteristics are so easy to use. If we got 1 million or 2 million or 3 million, we would put it all through mass vaccination centers and pharmacies and doctor's offices. And we would probably, and certainly it's not been approved yet, so there is no monograph to give us the exact detail, but just reading what other countries have laid out in their approvals, it's probably for people less than 65 years old. So we would say 64 years old down to, say, age 50 and put them through in the largest numbers possible and just kind of remove that population from the board from having to get vaccinations in the future. And therefore, they would be protected. So, yes, it would be a game changer.
I hope it is, because it sounds like it's another summer lost to COVID here for most people. I've got your last question about vaccinating migrant workers and undocumented people. The Migrant Rights Network is one group calling for a vaccine strategy for migrant workers. We've seen outbreaks in parts of southwestern Ontario before. Is there a plan on that?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And we've talked about the migrant workers, for example, in the farm sector, who are part of our food chain, obviously, to deliver our food to us. And they are absolutely crucial to our lives here in Canada, and they're human beings, and they're going to be part of the mass vaccination clinic. Either one will be established right in the midst of where they are, or a mobile vaccination clinic will go there and vaccinate them where they kind of live, where they work, because they need that protection too. And yes, we are going to include them in it. And we've walked through the plans with the public health unit as to how they are going to do it. And that's just it. They're going to do it as mass vaccination clinic or mobile clinics supporting that.
All right, I got to leave it there. I know everybody wants this vaccine very well. Retired General Hilliard, good to have you on the program. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Evan. We all want that vaccine, Evan.
Sure. You know, you're telling me. We all do. All right, the debate over medical assistance in dying continues. It's another big issue. The government legalized the practice, remember, in 2016. The legislation, though, was back in Parliament after a Quebec court ruled it was too restrictive. Now the Senate is saying you've got to widen it. They want more access to more Canadians. The Justice Minister, David Lametti, has accepted a major Senate amendment that would commit the government to opening assisted deaths to Canadians suffering from mental illness. But he isn't giving senators everything they want. Will the bill finally make it through Parliament, and who will finally have access to this? Let's find out. Joining me now is Canada's Justice Minister and Attorney General, David Lametti. Minister, great to have you back on the program. There's
pleasure.
A lot on your docket right now. I want to start with the extension that the government has asked for the medical assistance in dying law. This is, the fourth extension. The Senate had asked to be more inclusive for people with mental illness. I just want people to appreciate that. They want this more Canadians to have access to medical assistance in dying. You now seem to agree with that. Can you tell us if a Canadian who suffers from a grievous and irredeemable mental illness should have access to medical assistance in dying?
Well, as you've framed it, you've given us the criterion from the Carter case, and that's certainly been the motivating spirit throughout. What we're talking about is mental illness as the sole criterion for seeking medical assistance and dying. It's already possible in Canada to have mental illness as a comorbidity. So as another factor with other factors that have been recognized in the 2016 regime and what we propose under Bill C-7. I've said all along, this is a difficult issue. There are different opinions on it from the medical community. There is the question of respecting people with mental illness and not stigmatizing them and treating mental illness as a serious illness, which I think as a society, we're finally there. Thankfully, we finally come to understand that, but there's still more to know. So there was serious uncertainty. There still is. And I've said from the beginning, we need to work through that. We need more time. We need to study this carefully. We're still going to do that. The Senate amendment aligns with that. It just gives us a stricter timeline. They came back and said 18 months. We said 24. Yeah. But what we have done is, look, we have accepted the inevitability of doing this study. We're going to do it. We're going to do it seriously. And we've also, you'll note, in response to the Senate, actually proposed the mechanisms of how we're going to do it. We're going to add an expert review panel. We're going to put together an expert review panel and ask them to come back to us within 12 months of royal assent with proposals about how to operationalize this. We've also announced a joint committee of the House of Commons and the Senate to study all of the issues that were supposed to be present in the parliamentary review of C-14. So all the issues that we have said from the beginning, including mental illness, that we needed, that needed more study, advanced requests, mature minors, palliative care as well, and respect for the disabled. All of that is going to be done by a parliamentary committee, also to report within 12 months, to be composed within 30 days after royal assent. And then we've got another year after that for parliamentary processes to take the results of those two studies and to operationalize them.
Okay, so I just want, for those people that may not be as familiar, so this is why the government is asking for that extra extension. You want 2 years to get through that. There's a lot, and you know, you referenced the Carter case. Of course, that's the very critical Supreme Court case, the Carter case from 2015, which was a more expansive interpretation of who should have access to medical assistance in dying. We are talking about people who could qualify solely with a mental health issue, as I defined it earlier, the grievous and irredeemable mental health issue. But you said there's other things, you know, the advanced request, the disabled, the mature minors. There's a lot in here. So on one side, folks are saying you're too cautious, that the constitutional challenges will mean that that this will have to be available to all those people and that you're being too cautious. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the current law, Bill C-7, is constitutional, and I certainly respect what was done in the Carter decision as a Minister of Justice. And I would go back even further. You'll recall that I clerked for Justice Peter Corey, who was one of the dissenters in Rodriguez even before that. So I certainly respect the conclusion that the court came to in Carter. And I respect what we are trying to do as a government in Bill C-7. So I think it's constitutional. There is a difference of opinion there, but I'm quite confident that it is. Okay. But certainly moving forward, I want everything we do to be constitutional, and I want everything we do, even more importantly, to reduce the suffering of Canadians. I think that's the goal here.
On the other side, that you know, this is a complicated issue. There's no pretending otherwise. There are those who believe that there's not enough safeguards to avoid abuse of this, especially in mental health issues where it's more difficult to define. The Canadian Mental Health Association was disappointed. They say, look, you can't make medical assistance in dying an option to people with mental health issues unless you basically adequately fund the healthcare system to respond to mental health needs. In other words, that it should be a last resort. So will your government give more funds to provinces for mental health before you make this available, as they're talking about?
Well, Evan, you'll recall, I think that I'm not going to dispute that principle that more resources are needed for mental health services across Canada. No question. We began to do that. We invested $10 billion as a government in mental health a number of years back, and it was a centerpiece of what we were trying to do in the area of mental health. So I'm fully in agreement with that. We have put our money where our mouth is there, and we're going to continue to do that. The same is true. I'm also an advocate in favor of greater support for people living with disabilities, and this is enshrined in the Act. The Act itself has safeguards for people with disabilities, and actually the structure of the two regimes in the Act was precisely a response to what we heard from the leadership of the community of people living with disabilities. The same is true with mental health. We can't move forward without those kinds of safeguards. I know there are differences of opinions out there, so we're going to ask a committee of mental health experts to help us navigate that in order to find those safeguards. And then work with parliamentarians to do the rest.
Okay, let me talk about another thing. A study came out, government funded, by the way, from two experts on the prison system. And in 2019, your government was supposed to stop using solitary confinement, okay, unlawful prisoner isolation tactics, as it's called. Two researchers who just put out a report today on Correctional Services Canada who are using that, Anthony Dube and Jane Sprott, they're criminologists. I'm going to quote them. "We think the time has come for Canada to acknowledge it still has solitary confinement and it's torture by another name. How is it that 2 years after we were supposed to stop using it, it's still being used and these researchers are calling it torture?"
Well, I'm going to take a careful look at that report, along with Minister Blair, under whose responsibility the correctional system lies. We'll look at that report carefully. I obviously respect the work of Professor Dube and Professor Spratt. I have for a long time. I was part of the government that brought reform to the criminal justice system, the penal system, with respect to eliminating solitary confinement. We believe that as a principle. I believe that as a minister of justice. And so we're going to look at the report and find out where the recommendations are in order to change it. But certainly our intent was that it be eliminated.
I get it. I mean, you're the justice minister. It's not been eliminated. These two experts, they say the torture rate, I'm using their words, is about 15 per 1,000 prisoners, and they base that on their definition of how, like, this has got to, according to your own government, this has got to be stopped. I mean, are you talking to Bill Blair and say, this is torture? I'm the justice minister. When is it going to be stopped?
Well, look, again, I'm going to look at the report, which, you know, has just come out today.
Right.
But I'm aware of the work. I was certainly aware of that piece of legislation, and I was hopeful that it would eliminate the practice of solitary confinement for structured intervention units as a way to proactively improve the system. Obviously, we're going to look at what the report says. We're going to gather other information as well and evaluate the status of what's actually happening.
And just after this interview tonight, I know you're going to table legislation, something to do with incarceration and COVID. Can you give us any details before it gets tabled tonight?
I can't. It's a matter of parliamentary privilege that my parliamentary colleagues hear it first. So you'll have to wait until then.
Okay, well, something to do with COVID and something to do with incarceration, and we'll be looking for that later tonight. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll follow that to find out what legislation that might be when it's finally tabled. We'd love to hear from you if you have thoughts on our program or what you want us to ask the leaders. You can reach us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, or on email. Love to hear from you. Coming up, we're going to pick up that discussion. Is Canada torturing people in federal prisons? Why are two criminologists sounding the alarm about that very issue? We'll dig into that report with one of the co-authors next, so you get all the details. Plus, is it still realistic to think Canadians will all be vaccinated by the end of September? Dr. Abdul Sharkawi and Tom Mulcair will join us on the press gallery. Stay with Power Play. is Canada torturing prisoners in federal prisons? That's what a new report on the use of solitary confinement in Canada's federal prison system has concluded. Canada was supposed to have banned the unlawful use of solitary confinement or prisoner isolation tactics back in 2019. But a new report from two criminologists Anthony Dube and Jane Sprott conclude that the Correctional Services of Canada is still not only engaging in the practice, but it amounts to torture in certain cases. Courts have found that prolonged isolation of prisoners violates the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The United Nations Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners, also known as the Nelson Mandela Rules, calls the practice to be prohibited and only used as a, quote, last resort. The Mandela Rules list the use of solitary confinement as a form of torture or other cruel and inhumane or degrading treatment. The new report here in Canada concludes there is a lack of accountability in the use of solitary confinement, and that not enough has changed in Canada despite the government's new laws granting prisoners more time out of isolation. So what's happened since 2019 and what's going on now? Joining me now is the co-author of that report, criminologist Anthony Dube. Sir, thank you so much. The Mandela rules define the practice as 22 hours or more without meaningful human contact. Prolonged solitary confinement is that plus exceeding 15 consecutive days. Why do you and your co-author conclude that in some cases there's literally torture going on inside the federal prison system?
Well, as you said, what we did is we used the Mandela rules as a benchmark against which to evaluate what was going on in our penitentiaries. And what we did is we used Correctional Service of Canada data on the operation of these so-called structured intervention units. And we used their data to identify people who were essentially in solitary confinement for various lengths of time. And the Mandela rules suggest that after 15 days, a person really is being, should be considered to be tortured. So we identified those that are, in effect, being isolated for less than 15 days and for more than 15 days. And what we found was that there was a non-trivial number of people who fall into the Mandela rules definition of torture.
Correct. We contacted Correction Services Canada. If you need to get a drink of water, go ahead, sir. We contacted Correction Services Canada. And they did release a statement on the details of the new structured intervention units that replace solitary confinement. And I'll just read it to you. In part, they say, as of January 31st, 2021, there have been over 1,000 reviews of cases where an inmate does not receive their 4 hours out of cell or 2 hours of interaction for five consecutive days or 15 out of a 30-day period. They say this often happens, and I'm using their words, because an inmate, quote, refuses the opportunities that are offered daily, and they found that in 80% of the cases, the independent external decision makers has concluded that the Correctional Services Canada has taken all reasonable steps to provide the opportunities and engage the inmate with these opportunities. And in the remaining 20%, they've made recommendations to the CSC. So what do you make of that? They're basically saying, we're doing our best and prisoners refuse it.
I think clearly we know that there are reviews that are taking place. We would accept that. The problem is, what happened? What do these reviews consist of? How much information do the independent external decision makers actually have? And what happens when there's a difference of opinion? Because let's assume that the prisoner does say, I don't want to leave the cell. They can just leave it at that, or there can be a review of it. But what if the real reason that the prisoner doesn't want to leave the cell is that the prisoner's afraid? And the Correctional Service of Canada says, well, there's no reason for the prisoner to be afraid. But what if there's no real inquiry on that? The difficulty with this is we don't really have transparency. Our data are admittedly just the administrative data about what's happening. At an absolute minimum, they have an enormous number of people who are refusing to leave their cells in a Canadian penitentiary. They're refusing to leave their cells in general, and they're refusing to leave their cells for meaningful human contact. Now, that in itself should tell you something, or should be a red flag that there's a problem. So they can say, well, we're doing these reviews and, you know, the reviewers, on the basis of the information that Correction Service of Canada gives to them, says that there's no problem. But we don't really know this. This isn't an open process in any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, so just what needs to happen now? This was supposed to have ended in 2019. You've seen their statement. We clearly need more transparency. We do have a correctional investigator, I should say, Ivan Zinger. But what needs to happen now, sir?
Well, I think there does need to be some form of continual review of these most serious kinds of placements within our penitentiary. There's also a very good argument that's been made for more than 50 years that there should be a judicial or some very formal oversight on the placement of prisoners into these units, whatever it is that one wants to call them. That would be a good start. But I think that the problem at the moment is the decisions by the independent external decision makers is pretty private. And second is the only kind of systematic oversight is from the administrative data that Jane Sprott and I have been working on. And that, you know, that's certainly a lot better than nothing, but it doesn't tell you what's really happening on the ground. Those people who are watching what's happening on the ground are just as concerned as we are, the people in British Columbia, for example.
Well, we need more transparency on that. All right, sir, I really appreciate you joining us today. Mr. Dube, thank you about that really critical report, trying to pull back the curtain on what's really going on inside our correctional facilities. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up, more doses of the vaccine are coming, but is Canada's vaccine rollout actually working? Check this out.
Did the Prime Minister's slow approach on the vaccine rollout guarantee a third wave of COVID-19 for Canada?
Politics is getting in the way sometimes of getting some answers, but we'll try to get you some answers. Dr. Abdul Sharkawi and Tom Mulcair join us on the press gallery next. Stay with us. Well, the vaccines are supposed to be coming. You know, we spend a lot of time saying we need more vaccines on the federal government side. Well, what about on the provincial side? Well, game on for provinces as they roll out their vaccine plan. The schedules, well, they're slow. There's confusion. No one can book an appointment, for example, in Ontario until March 22nd because their portal's not ready. Now, I just had General Rick Hillier, who's in charge of it. He said it doesn't even need to be ready there, but Alberta rolled out theirs. There's clearly a desire. They were flooded with people who can book 75 and up so quickly that it actually crashed. That's right, the enthusiasm crashed the system. In Quebec, by next week, people 85 and up will be able to get mass inoculated. Look, is Canada going to hit the vaccine targets? Why is there so much confusion? Let's put this to the press gallery. Steph Levitz is a reporter with the Canadian Press. Robert Benzie is the Toronto Star's Queen's Park Bureau Chief. Tom Mulcair is a political analyst with CTV News. And we've got our CTV News infectious disease specialist, Dr. Abdul Sharkawi here. Guys, we're going to go two blocks on this. Welcome, everybody. Doc, I always thank you for your work. You're in Ontario. So let's just spend a little time on Ontario that rolled out its plan just this afternoon. What do you make of the plans? You've got 34 different health units. You've got a portal that's not open until, what, March 15th? You can't even start booking until March 22nd. What do you make of this whole rollout strategy, Dr. Sharkawi?
I think the strategy in principle is actually quite sound. When you look at it and you look at the makeup of who will actually be helping administer these vaccines, especially if it's going to be anchored by primary care, if you're going to have pharmacies formatively involved, and if you're going to have mass vaccine clinics, particularly in more heavily populated areas, those are all good things. The other thing is that if the vaccine supply improves, and if you're looking at areas that are more heavily impacted, some of those age cutoffs may change in terms of the time in which some people may receive their vaccines. And that is a good thing. Now, obviously, the devil is in the details here in terms of how this actually gets rolled out. And there's going to be a lot of moving parts. It's a tall order. But I think on principle, it's a sound strategy. It's just the execution, which obviously is going to mean everything at the end of the day.
Rob Renzi, what do you make of the fact that the portal's late? Family doctors I've talked to don't have any clue when they're going to be used or if they're going to be used. And I know there's a lot of frustration for the vast majority of people aren't even going to get a shot until the summer, which throws the targets into question. What do you make of it all, Mr. Renzi?
Well, you know what, Evan, it is confusing and frustrating. I mean, for the first sort of 2 months of 2021, we've been frustrated about the lack of vaccines, the actual medicines that haven't been as widely available in Canada as perhaps Canadians had hoped or would like. Now we're looking and seeing the provinces rolling out their different strategies, and there's frustration, at least here in Ontario, that we don't have much clarity. I mean, I don't know why it will take until March 15th to have a website open so that you can book your appointment. That doesn't really make much sense to me, because I mean, a website like that could be up and running right now, and just so you could have an idea of how this is going to work. So, we don't know, for example, we know the next wave of people being vaccinated will be there'll be the 600,000 Ontarians who are 80 and over. But people in their 70s and in their 60s are looking around going, well, when are we going to get our shots? And it's much, much later in the year than they had hoped and or would like.
Steph, what's your read on how this is rolling out? And boy, even in just speaking of Ontario, if people under the age of 65 don't get it, start getting it till July, they've got, by my count, between 10 and 11 million people in less than 3 months to get the job done. What do you make of everything?
Well, for one, I mean, I think I've said it before on your show, Evan, these targets are political fiction. They don't exist for any other reason than political optics. So we meet them, we don't meet them. I mean, the real issue is, do the most vulnerable citizens in our country have rapid access to these vaccines in such a way that we're going to see, one, spread in really risky and vulnerable populations begin to decline, and as it declines with it, the severity of illness and deaths. And it seems to me that most provinces are definitely making headway in that respect. What they're contending with is a number of different things. I mean, think about the recommendations that are put out nationally for who should get the vaccine and how. Very recently, those changed. It will change, as Dr. Sharkawi said, based on what vaccines get approved next, because there are different realities for the AstraZeneca vaccine. There's different realities for Johnson & Johnson. The issue seems to be, as it always seems to come down to with this, is political communications and optics getting in the way of reality and people being too afraid to tell Canadians up front what the problems are. Why do you not have a website? You can say, well, we don't need it. Well, but people want it, so why don't you have it? Answer the questions people are asking, and it goes a long way, and then they don't get frustrated when they hear one thing on Monday and a different thing on Thursday.
Well, they hear one thing, and then or they see it. Oh, wait, Alberta's got it, but Ontario doesn't. They're mass inoculating, Tom, in Quebec next week for people over 85, but they're not doing that in Ontario till mid-March. Give us the Quebec perspective on how you think it's all playing out sort of jurisdiction by jurisdiction, Tom.
All the jurisdictions are in the same boat because you can't manage what you can't count. So they're all basing themselves on the most recent guesses about how many doses. If Mr. Trudeau gets them out magically in the numbers he's predicting, then the problem will now be on the backs of the provinces, because Mr. Trudeau will have done his part. The actual delivery is theirs. Quebec did something I think was quite simple, but it's actually working. They took the template from the last time we had a big inoculation program, which was more than a decade ago, H1N1. They've just taken that whole system that was already built. They've taken it off the shelf. They're retooling it, and they're running it again for this one for COVID-19. And it's apparently working. So sometimes you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
And Dr. Sharkawi, I guess we're not going to hold back second doses in some provinces now. Maybe Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca, we cross our fingers, they come on. Does that change the equation and these long timelines that looks like a lost COVID summer for most Canadians, another COVID summer? Does that change the equation if all these come in?
Well, there's no question that it will. We've got very good and cumulative evidence at this point in time that one dose probably has much more durable efficacy than we originally thought. 92%, in fact, when you're looking at Pfizer and Moderna. So withholding doses makes no sense at all. I expect the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to be approved very soon. That's going to be a one-shot deal. And I expect the AstraZeneca to fall closely thereafter in terms of approval from Health Canada. So I think the timeline is still very much in question. You're looking at still, you know, we've got only 5% of our population at this point that has received at least one dose, and only 1.2% of all Canadians have been fully vaccinated. So we've got our work cut out for us to try and make up, you know, 50, 60, 70 more percent to get to a herd immunity state in 7 months. That's going to be a big challenge, even if we have as many doses as we can get from multiple vaccine platforms. But it's certainly going to improve compared to where we are right now.
Yeah, gosh, I sigh when you say 6 or 7 more months. Can we just take a short break? I want to come back and talk about the politics of the pandemic, the rollout, the provinces balancing their needs with the federal government's supply, and if we're going to maybe get these quicker, and what it means when Canadians are watching, you know, other countries move faster on these key issues. So we'll take a break. The Press Gallery is going to be right back. Stay right here with Power Play. The politics of the pandemic continue. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau told Canadians that anybody who wanted a vaccine could get one by September. But the vaccine rollout is dictated, of course, by the provinces. Yes, we're going to be getting lots more vaccines, but for the vast majority of Canadians, it won't be until the summer until you get a shot. So how will that work, and what questions still remain on these timelines? There's just a lot of confusion and, frankly, a lot of growing frustration. It's totally understandable. Steph Levitz from the Canadian Press is here. Robert Benzie from the Toronto Star is here. Tom Mulcaire, political analyst for CTV News, is here. And CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdu Sharkari. Let me just go back to you, Steph Levitz. Look, there's a patchwork of different vaccine rollouts from the provinces. Justin Trudeau's, you know, we're ramping up the vaccine. But what are now the political implications as Canadians are starting to come to that realization that the summer is not going to be free of the virus for most Canadians?
The political ramifications depend on which level of government they ultimately decide to hold responsible for this. Is it the way the federal government procured vaccines? Is it the way provincial governments chose to roll them out? Is it the way municipal governments did or didn't provide the space and work with their local health units to make things happen? You know, here in Ottawa, for example, there's, you know, repeat breakouts, outbreaks right now in homeless shelters. And that's an issue that I'm sure will hit municipal politics at that particular level. And so where are Canadians going to look? It's a long time before most of the country provincially goes to the polls. The next election we're most likely going to have is the federal one. And so how successful will the opposition parties be at laying all of this blame squarely at Justin Trudeau's feet? Or if it's a fall election, which is, you know, looking like a likely, the most likely scenario right now, if there's going to be one at all, if the vast majority of Canadians do in fact have that shot in their arm come September, is all of what we're talking about now just a distant memory?
Right. Yeah, Robert Benzie, it just seems that there's a shortage of clarity. Let's just talk on the provincial side. I think the federal government's finally been clear about when we're getting it. Whether it's enough or not is obviously a very big debate. But on the provincial side, you've got seniors are saying, when am I going to get it? Where am I going to get it? Who's going to give it to me? Do we have a communication confusion issue across the country?
Yeah, I think that we do. I think it's really frustrating for Canadians, especially. We have a kind of a unique viewpoint on the world because we're so, you know, we're next door to the United States, where I was speaking to someone in Washington yesterday who could not believe that every single day in the United States, they vaccinate more people than we've vaccinated in total so far during the pandemic. And they're up to like 65 million vaccines dispensed in the United States, which is incredible. And, you know, Canadians watch a lot of American television and read American newspapers and so on. So they're seeing that news. And then they're turning around saying, well, why is it like that here? And that's put a lot of pressure on Prime Minister Trudeau. It's put a lot of pressure on premiers like Doug Ford and François Legault, because they have to explain to their people who are watching American television and so on, say, hey, yeah, it's not quite up to speed to scratch here in Canada.
Tom, weigh in on that, if you will.
We might not know what's in those contracts, but what we do know is that there's a bit of a Cheshire Cat grin on Mr. Trudeau whenever he talks about millions and millions of doses in short order. He's getting this monkey off his back, and I'm a little bit different in my opinion than that Stephanie just expressed. I watched last week. You roll out your gun answer. That doesn't satisfy everyone, but at least there's an answer. You roll out a big policy on official languages. good part of the liberal base, Francophones outside Quebec, Acadians loved it. Mr. Trudeau's doing that. He's reassuring his base. And magically, he comes up with exactly 12 more weeks of the CERB benefit. Where does that put us? Maybe the end of May. So I think that there is a real chance that if he can clear the debris off his runway, and of course, the Conservatives are going to do everything they can to throw some debris back and try, like they did at Question Period today, say, Trudeau's fault, Trudeau's fault, Trudeau's fault. But you know what? It's not going to stick if millions and millions of doses have come in. It'll be on the backs of the provinces, if at all. And with any luck, Evan, maybe millions and millions of Canadians will be vaccinated in short order if we can actually get it done.
Yeah, listen, if AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson come, I think we got to throw out the timelines and import something, which would be way better. But let me just give the last word to Dr. Sharkawi. You know, my son came down. One of my kids said, Dad, is the summer lost to COVID? And the kids under the age of 16, we don't even know as parents if they're even going to get the vaccine. What are some of the questions that families have as we're, you know, almost a year into this? We still don't know. People don't know when they're going to get it, how they're going to get it. So it's not just the politics. It's frankly the reality for people, Doc.
Yeah, there's a lot of logistical issues here that definitely need to be remedied. They need to improve. And I think it's going to take a lot of coordination. And it's going to take, I think, really emphasizing the importance of hitting heavily impacted communities. And I think in Ontario, the COVID task force has prioritized that. I'm hopeful that that's something that will be taken to heart and that more resources will be deployed in areas that are more disproportionately affected. We will be in a much better place. I think the key question is, are we going to be able to avoid a third wave in the meantime with variants if we monitor our restrictions? That's the bigger question to me right now.
Well, we hope the vaccine variant race, gosh, we don't want to lose that. Guys, I got to leave it there. Steph Levitz, Robert Benzi, Dr. Sharkawi, Tom Mulcair. Just great having the four of you on. Just really appreciate it. And thank all of you for watching. That's your Power Play Day in Politics. We are back here in 23 short hours. If it's safe and if you can, hug your loved ones. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Have a great evening.